The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello, this is the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine into print. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm Gus Carter, The Spectator's deputy features editor. This week we'll be discussing what achieving a large majority at the next election could mean for Labour, how worried parents should be about picky eating in their children, and humanity's fascination with the apocalypse. Why are we so obsessed with the end of the world?
This week, our cover piece explores the impact on the Labour Party should they win a landslide later this year. It's written by our political editor, Katie Balls, and on the cover, we've depicted Keir Starmer as a future PM, backed up by government benches that can only be described as bulging. But does such a large majority open up the possibility of civil wars within the Labour Party?
We sat down with Katie to discuss her piece alongside former deputy leader of the Labour Party, Harriet Harman. Harriet has served in Parliament for 42 years and is stepping down at the next election.
Katie, in your cover piece this week, you explore what a supermajority would look like for Labour should Keir Starmer win big at the next election. And actually, in fact, YouGov released a poll yesterday showing Labour on course to win over 400 seats at the next election. I suppose most people might think that Keir Starmer should be pretty happy about that. But as you say in your piece, large majorities present internal challenges, don't they? Can you start by talking us through that?
Yeah, so I think there are two reasons this poll is a bit of a problem for Keir Starmer. The first is that the main message from Labour these days is don't be complacent and stay focused. So I think there's a task of just getting to the election. And therefore, you have the message from Morgan McSweeney, Keir Starmer's senior aide, which is, you know, no one has cast a vote yet. Look what happened. You know, historically, Labour does not win many elections in the UK, and we cannot get our hopes up. And how do you keep MPs focused on the task of discipline and winning when all the polls suggest you're about to have the largest majority in modern history? Then the next issue, I think, is if we actually take the polls as perhaps not the most likely, the polls could narrow for election, but if we take it as a reasonable scenario of what could happen, which I think after two MRPs and what's happened with the Tories, you can, what does that mean for politics? And I think it would just change many things fundamentally if you were to have a majority so large. There's one MRP for the Sunday Times, the Salvation one, which is suggesting a majority just under 300. That's the working majority. The one in the Times YouGov poll is a little bit less optimistic. I think that's a below 200 majority, still huge. And therefore, it comes with it, I think, suddenly you'd have a situation where, sure, the Tories that reduced to a rump could say a few things and get a little bit of attention. The Lib Dems, let's say they had got 50 MPs, could say a few things, get a bit of attention. But I think it would be very much almost as though the opposition was within the Labour Party just because of the vast size. You'll probably have new factions, despite the efforts to make sure that the new intake of stormtroopers, as we previously called them. It would just be inevitable. And I think it would change the window of debate to the left, where you have a situation where right now, Keir Starmer thinks a lot about, you know, trying to appeal to Tory voters. Now, those voters don't disappear. But just in terms of, I think, the political realities of having that many Labour MPs, suddenly the conversations are going to be with one another, I think, than more with the opposition. And that will really, I think, have a big impact that perhaps we're not quite appreciating yet.
Harriet, I suppose it's a rather happy problem for Keir Starmer to have this huge majority. But from his perspective, he's going to have a lot of new MPs that are kind of fresh to Parliament, that might be quite inexperienced when it comes to politics, and also a kind of greater desire for radicalism when you have a large majority. How do you manage a problem like that?
Well, the first thing, and Katie referred to this, you know, that the Keir and his office have got a thankless task trying to dampen expectations, because as soon as we read the opinion polls, you know, we get giddy with enthusiasm. But we do have to remember that, you know, sometimes people's expectations can be confounded. You know, we were expected to win in 92, and we weren't even a minority government. The Tories continued to have a majority government, having been in since 1979. And again in 2010, we were expected to be down the pan and lose completely. But actually, the Conservatives didn't win an overall majority. So I think that it is very difficult to keep your feet on the ground as a Labour person, with the polls being quite as optimistic as they are. But, you know, the Leader's Office are absolutely right to say, you know, focus on the job in hand. The other thing that is kind of slightly undermining their attempts to dampen expectations is the by-elections, which have been, again, overwhelmingly people saying to the Conservative government, by the way, time's up. You know, if you think you've got a mandate to govern, here we are in this by-election and we're going to take our opportunity to tell you you haven't. But I don't agree with the next point that a big majority is a problem. A big majority is much less of a problem than a small majority. And that's even less of a problem than being a minority government. So, you know, a big majority is a luxury. And I think also it's always the case that if you've been out of government for a long time, there are very few people when you're in government who've had previous government experience. I mean, we've got some MPs coming back in, like Emma Reynolds, who's been members previously. We've got Hilary Benn, Pat McFadden, Yvette Cooper, who've been in senior positions in government before, but they are the minority. But I think that's always the case if you've been out of government for a long time. But it doesn't mean they're inexperienced people. And I think what's been quite interesting about and looking at these new candidates that are selected, and I don't know whether it's just that there's a sniff of power and therefore a lot of incredibly good people have left their extremely good jobs to quest to be Labour MPs in the hope that they might be ministers. They are going to be an extremely good cadre of Labour MPs. And what's interesting is in the past, there was a temptation to focus on your selections for people who are going to be bound to be MPs because they were in retirement seats or were in the marginal seats that you hoped to win. This time, what Keir Starmer and the team have been doing is paying close attention to all the candidates selected, including those that are in seats where we literally 100% are not going to win. And that's for two reasons. Firstly, because when you don't want just ahead of the general election, some candidate from a seat which they were never expected to win anyway, suddenly resigning from the Labour Party, denouncing Keir Starmer as useless and kind of destabilising things. Once you've got the kind of moniker of a candidate, you've got a bit of power. So we want all the candidates to be really worthy of carrying the Labour flag. But also the other thing is that you've got to be careful when the opinion polls are like this. We might win seats that we are really not expecting to. And that did happen in 1997. You know, we got Bob Marshall Andrews from Kent. And what they're doing is they're actually picking very, very good people in seats where really we shouldn't be winning, but there's just a possibility that we might.
Katie, you do point out, though, that a lot of the candidates will be fairly young. And there's an interesting point in your piece where you talk about this effective kind of finishing school that's being run for some of the new intake. Can you talk a little bit about what you found out about that?
Yeah, I mean, to Harriet's point, I mean, if you look at the current turnover, if you look at where the polls are, about half of Labour MPs probably have no experience of Parliament, and no post-war party will have had that level of change. So it is the case that, yes, when you've had a long time out of government, there's less memory muscle and so forth. And you see Keir Starmer wanting figures in his cabinet who do have experience of being in government before, if you look at some of those hires. But it does mean, and this is a problem that the Leader's Office are grappling with, and I agree, it is a good problem to have, as opposed to the problem of, are we going to have to govern with a majority of two? But one of the problems is, how do you suddenly train up this huge cohort of MPs so they know what they're doing, so they don't fall into some of the pitfalls of Westminster? Because if you speak to some after the 2019 election, that was a majority of 80. And I think that the whips feel as though, partly because of the pandemic, they ended up with these very unruly MPs who all thought they had their own social media brands. And Keir Starmer's office are also trying to learn lessons from those from the Blair era about what they did about having, you know, a big majority and getting to know those MPs, what they got right, what they got wrong. But they've been having lots of, in the piece I call it effectively, you know, a Westminster finishing school, but it is summer away days, summer away weekends even. But the large focus is these online sessions they're doing almost every week, where you'll have Morgan McSweeney or Pat McFadden, the two working on the campaign, just updating the candidates over Zoom, and they'll be saying, oh, these are our campaign messaging, this is why we're saying it. And then you're also having shadow ministers coming on and giving, you know, various briefings, whether it's, you know, a post-budget briefing, and you get someone like Darren Jones, the shadow chief secretary, or Angela Rayner. I think when the point came that there was not going to be a May election because the deadline had been missed, it was more of a pep talk one. We're saying, you know, they bottled it, but keep going because we're going to do well. So trying to keep momentum up, because it's a very long wait if you're a candidate to get to that election. And I think some of these, you know, when it comes to the training, you know, I think some of this is about, how do you run an office? Some of it is also, how do you do public speaking? How do you stand up tall? And all those aspects. So it is trying to get to all the points where I think there could be weaknesses. And I think there's also a question about how you get the balance right between spending time in Westminster and spending time in your constituency. Because interestingly, some of the new Labour grandees think they focused a bit too much on, don't fall into the pitfalls of Westminster. And then before they know it, almost the candidate spent too little time in Westminster, and they don't want that to happen either. So I think all those things are coming together.
But can I pick up some of the things that Katie said? Because I think that you can't read across from how the new MPs who won in 2019, the new Tory MPs, were, and compared to what is going to be like for our new Labour MPs in 2024, because they were already the government. I think what you can't underestimate is how different it is when you're going from out of government into government. And that creates a kind of halo effect round the leader, a sort of honeymoon period. And there's kind of an assumption somehow, often, that new, younger MPs who've got no experience of Westminster will be more rebellious. But actually, there's equally the possibility that they can be more compliant and more grateful for getting in, more relieved that we no longer have a Tory government, and very hyper-anxious not to rock the boat.
Harriet, Katie mentions in the piece that Labour will probably be hiring quite a few people from the Tony Blair Institute. And Tony Blair has a house near Chequers, the Prime Minister's countryside residence. I suppose he knows better than almost anyone how you govern a very large majority. What influence do you think he'll have on a future Labour government?
Well, I think that Blair's influence is kind of in the water. It's not necessarily him pulling the levers as an individual or organising people. It's the kind of political analysis that he had about economic prosperity and social justice going hand in hand and moving the party to the centre ground. And that still obtains under Keir's leadership. So there is a kind of it's not machinations, it's still quite a lot of ideological hegemony for what Blair did, which is to get us out of opposition into government. And Keir is trying to do the same. He's trying to get us out of opposition into government. So I think there's, you know, people like to talk a lot about personalities and machinations. I think there's less of that than generally people learning from the evidence of what Tony Blair did, which, you know, we can all see what he did. So I think there's reference back, but there's a lot of things which are very different now. You know, we've got AI, which could be the salvation of public services. If we massively are able to cut the cost by using AI, then that can free resources up for frontline services. We've got the green agenda, which is going to be important in a way it wasn't in 1997. Although I was looking at the 1997 manifesto the other day, as you do, and I was astonished at how green it was. I mean, we didn't do much greenery when we were in government, not a huge amount, and we certainly weren't known for that. But actually, it was right there in the manifesto. But it's clearly going to be a very big issue. So that there is the ideological positioning that comes with Tony Blair's still influence after all these years because of his success. And then there is the new practical issues which the government are going to have to deal with.
And Harriet, just finally, one of the points that Katie makes is at the point where Labour take over, they will have a serious moment of power and support, and that is the moment to get things done. What do you think Starmer should do first? What would you be advising him to focus on?
Well, he's already said what he's going to do first. I mean, what you do is you have a period where you can set a different sort of tone. You can change the culture by doing things that previous government would not have thought of doing, like, for example, changing workers' rights, improving workers' rights, like setting up a national wealth fund, like establishing Great British Energy, like doing cleaning up of politics. So they'll do things which start things going in a different direction. Remember, one of the first bills we brought into Parliament was the national minimum wage, but it wasn't implemented for 2 years. So actually, you can change the feel of things by going off in a different direction, but actually the practical changes don't happen for a couple of years down the line, but people will know they're coming.
Harriet and Katie, thank you very much.
Gus, what did you like in the magazine this week?
In the magazine this week, I liked Charles. I always like Charles Moore. He's got an item in his Spectator notes this week that I've got in front of me, in which he points out that someone on Twitter could start an argument, an English person, someone in England with someone in Scotland, and insult them. And then under the new Hate Crime Act, if the person replied in kind, the Scottish person, they would be liable to prosecution while the English person would get off scot-free, which I thought was very entertaining. What did you enjoy, Lara?
I enjoyed Mary's interview this week, Gus, with Rob Henderson, the author and academic who's now based in Cambridge. He came up with the idea of luxury beliefs, and Mary speaks to him about what luxury beliefs are, which are essentially kind of privileged opinions that you can have which don't actually affect you but will affect other people. Mm. He went through eight foster homes before the age of nine in America, and his particular kind of bugbear is the pernicious idea, he says, that the old two-parent family is outdated. So I would recommend that to readers. I also very much enjoyed Christopher Matthews' piece on A.A. Milne's time working at Punch magazine in his early 20s when he was an assistant editor on the magazine. There's a particular quote which I found quite pertinent where he says, A.A. Milne wrote that he knew of no work, manual or mental, to equal the appalling, heartbreaking anguish of fetching an idea from nowhere, which, Gus, I'm sure we can both appreciate. I should also mention that we have a piece by Hannah Moore about picky eating for children. Hannah reveals in her piece that her husband, one William Moore, only ate chicken nuggets for a year. Will's obviously not here this week, so he's not.
He isn't ill. It isn't because he's eating too many chicken nuggets.
Hannah's a brilliant writer and has done a great piece. And Hannah and Mary joined us earlier to talk about picky eating.
Hannah, in this week's magazine, you write that anyone who expects children to enjoy cooked courgette has forgotten what it's like to be a child. Are we expecting too much of our children?
Well, I just think we're focusing way too much on every aspect of child rearing instead of letting kids kind of be part of our lives. So, I mean, I don't always have a lot of time on my hands, and so I don't always have the opportunity to make a big, like, spend hours making a long cooked meal for them. So that I might just use a, you know, canned tomato sauce for the kids, but I feel guilty doing that.
Guilty for a canned tomato sauce.
I love it in the Moore household. Yeah.
canned tomatoes are tomatoes are totally fine. I don't know what's wrong with that.
That's true. Yeah, some of the branded ones, though, you know, they've got sugar on them and things. So if you read the back, you might find more reason to make yourself feel bad. But yeah, I just think that we're sitting there watching children eat too much. I think we should just give them the food and get on with things.
Mary, what's your take on this? Do you worry about picky eating or are you relaxed about it?
I didn't really worry about it so much, but then my kid, who's too young to listen to podcasts, was just incredibly greedy and ate everything, so I never had to worry. But I would worry a little bit, like if he just ate, I mean, I think, Hannah, you said that your husband will just eat chicken nuggets when at one stage. I think I would worry a little bit about that.
For a whole year.
For a whole year, you know, nutritionally. Yes. So, yeah, no, I didn't have to worry, but I don't think I'd be quite as comfortable.
Yes. Well, my older sister has four children, and her oldest is older than mine. And when I was there, I was there visiting in America when he was about 5 months old. And I remember she was feeding him potatoes with turmeric and saffron or something and some chili powder. And I was just amazed that he was eating it. And she said, if you introduce it early, spices and things, that they will take to it. I tried that with my kids. There is no way. And if you give them even just a hint of chili or pepper, they'll start screaming like it's hurting them.
There's a strange sense now, though, that children should be eating the same things as adults, which I think is quite odd. And I think previous generations find that quite peculiar, that every child should be eating kind of ottolenghi. I mean, Mary, when you were younger, were you eating similar things to what Kevin
eats? I think the British tradition is a little weird, isn't it? Like every restaurant just does. You've got normal food and then you've got kids' mini pizza, chicken nuggets, pasta and sauce. But, you know, French children, at least in my mind, kind of, you know, enjoy a little salad and blue cheese before. I think that is sort of true, though. In other European countries, kids eat adult food.
I was once at a farmer's market in North London, being a, you know, liberal, wet journalist, and I heard a mother turn to her small toddler and say, "We're going to get you some oysters to expand your palate."
That is normal. That's normal in NY. Yeah. I mean, the packed lunch now is extraordinary, right? You know, the avocado is really boring. They're off that. There's, you know, all sorts of...
And bad for the environment, of course.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Oh, wow, the politics of the packed lunch. I hadn't even considered that.
Oh, my God,
that.
Yeah, it's pretty intense.
Oh, yeah, I feel guilty about that every 3 days when I send my son to preschool. I send him with a cheese sandwich because that's what he likes. But I'm always going through the aisles at, you know, Tesco or something, looking for, you know, nice things that I could pack for him, and he just doesn't want them. He wants a cheese sandwich.
Do you think also, Hannah, I mean, you talk about just wanting to give your children food that they enjoy. Presumably that also makes your life easier. I mean, I feel there's nothing more depressing than cooking something for children and then they just turn their noses up at it.
Yeah. And like I said in the article, I used to make these very elaborate meals for them. And you know, I still will. I'll test it out. I'll make something that I like, say, and something that's complicated, and then serve them, try and put it alongside their meal to see if they will try it. But they just go, "Eh, disgusting," which is not, yeah. So they have it. They do have it around. And it's funny, you know, about French people and things, you know, more exotic food like blue cheese and all that is around in our house. You know, they see us eating it. So I just, you know, the idea that kids would probably take part more if the food was there in front of them, that just doesn't hold true with my kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bigger picture of what you say is, you know, we just do watch the kids too much, you know, whether they like the food or they don't, this obsessive observation of what's in their packed lunch and what's going on. And I have a friend who comes around and she so worries about what her kids eat that if the child doesn't like something I've cooked, and I'm not a good cook, it takes me ages to make her something for lunch, she'll say, "What else have you got?" I'm like, you know, I've just made a chicken and meat pie. It took me ages. I'm not to get something else out the freezer. Your child's just effectively eaten 10 hours of my time. So maybe the mini pizza's a good idea. I don't know.
Yeah. And also, I think one thing that one shouldn't get in the habit of doing is offering them something else if they've rejected the meal that you've...
Yeah, very much agree.
So I just want my kids to eat and be full and not whine about it later. So that's why I tend to serve them things that I know they'll like, that they know they'll like. And occasionally, I can tell when they're in a growth spurt because they start to eat more stuff. And that's when I slip in something new. So recently I made a hard-boiled egg for Patrick because we did Easter egg dyeing. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity to try and get him some more protein. So I gave him a hard-boiled egg just on the side, and he ate it. So There's some progress there, but it's about when they're feeling ready, I think, to try new things.
Yeah, this all sounds very wet to me. I feel like I'm getting nostalgic
for the days, you know, where we had to sit, like at school, sit in front of the semolina and prunes for 24 hours and came back the next day.
If we didn't want
to bring back those days.
If we didn't want to eat, our mum just said, there's yogurt and fruit, and that's it. These are your options. Yeah. Right? I kind of think children need to have it forced on them.
Exactly.
If you won't eat your liver, there's a moldy old orange.
Liver with tubes.
Yeah, and of course, eventually they will eat, surely. Yeah.
You mentioned Christina Hardiman's brilliant book, Dream Babies, which I think you actually recommended to me a while ago. It's a history of child rearing, isn't it? And perhaps you could talk a bit about that, because I feel like the main message seems to be that everything is a phase with children and also with kind of child rearing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and we all say, like, oh, back in my parents' days, you know, we would have been given food and told to shut up and eat it or whatever. And this stuff all comes in cycles, doesn't it? So with their parents' generations, maybe they thought they were wet or whatever. And at some point, you know, it changes kind of every generation. And so I loved her book because it points out that this changes all the time. And we might as well, instead of kind of hand-wringing about the age that we're living in, maybe not being as sensible as the one before, trying to just kind of not think about, not internalize about it too much, and just, you know, just do what works for you, what works for you and your kids. And that's kind of where I've come to after my wise 5 years of being a mom. Whereas before, I used to feel really like I was questioning every decision. And I think, Mary, you've said before as well that the kind of agony you can get into as a parent of overthinking everything. And with food, you know, what you're putting into your kid every single day is important. But your sanity and your time and your happiness as a parent is just as important too.
You certainly don't want them sort of seeing your anxiety and the watchfulness as they eat. That'll give them no end of problems.
And just finally, is that, I'm going to ask you both for one dish that you know you can cook and always be...
You gave me no warning of this. Over to you, Hannah.
You first. What do you always cook and your children adore it?
Well, the staid favourite is cheesy pasta that I make from scratch, which makes me feel slightly better. But it's a cheddar cheese sauce, but I put a little bit of truffle oil, little bit of parmesan and milk, and it's very yummy, and I could eat it as well. So it's not like a disgusting packet macaroni and cheese. So it's fresh, and they shout for joy when I tell them it's cheesy pasta for tonight.
The only real success I've had, I think, is my son will eat soup, you know, so I can just liquidize stuff, but beetroot soup, because it turns everything purple. Wow. So you'd never normally eat a beetroot, but if you can turn the entire kitchen and everything kind of maroon, goes down a treat. So yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. You could get beetroot into them. Yeah, that's great.
Gus, have you ever been a picky eater?
I didn't like mushrooms or tomatoes, but I think 15 years of heavy smoking sorts your taste buds on your tongue out, and actually you can enjoy anything after that.
Mary and Hannah, thank you very much. And now on to the apocalypse. Finally, we've got a review of Dorian Lynskey's new book, Everything Must Go, The Stories We Tell About the End of the World, in which he presents a catalogue of catastrophe from AIDS to zombies. And it's the lead review in this week's issue. So we're joined by Chris Begley and Dorian to talk about the apocalypse.
Dorian, your new book, Everything Must Go, deals with stories that humans tell ourselves about the end of the world. Why is it that you think we're so fascinated by the apocalypse?
It's to do with something I think quite psychologically deep that goes back to, I mean, at least the book of Revelation. It's a combination of seeking moments of crisis and endpoints and conclusions to our story, and often in the religious sense, seeking some moment of transformation, of radical transformation, even if it involves great violence and destruction and suffering, there's the promise of something new. And I think it just comes out of just an endless frustration with the world as it is, and a frustration with trying to improve the world gradually, and kind of wanting some kind of mighty conflagration to just sort of fix everything in some way so that we can start again in another form.
And Dorian, can you take listeners through how you approach the subject of the apocalypse? How have you structured the book?
Well, I found a really good book from the 30s called The End of the World, where a writer called Jeffrey Dennis had seven different categories, and my categories are not his. Mine have been updated, but I really liked that idea. So the seven sections, the first one is The Last Man and the idea of The Last Man. Then there's Impact, which is comets and asteroids. The Bomb, which is self-explanatory. Machines, robots and AI. Collapse, which is a sort of catastrophe and post-apocalyptic genre. Then Pandemic, and then Climate. And so it's sort of, it's semi-chronological, but trying to sort of build a story through these sort of distinct but overlapping visions.
Chris, you're an archaeologist and you've written your own book, The Next Apocalypse, in which you argue that humans fundamentally misunderstand the concept of disaster. Do you mind explaining that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it goes to the same question of why we create these apocalyptic narratives and the way in which we create them. And part of what I see as an archaeologist is that the narratives we create, everything from the religious narratives to the, you know, popular narratives today, really rely on some assumptions about the way things have happened in the past. And as an archaeologist looking at what actually happened, we see some real deviation from what we see depicted in these narratives. One of the biggest ones would be sort of the role of the individual, or, you know, the sort of this heroic take on surviving and ascending on the other side of an apocalyptic event, you know, when in fact it's always been community. It's always been a much different path than we often envision.
And Dorian, the categories that you outlined just there, the seven of them, out of those, which ones did you find the kind of most compelling as possible apocalyptic scenarios?
I suppose it depends at which point in history you're living. So obviously climate seems far more pressing than comets, which comets were a very, very big deal at one point, and let's not rule them out. And then obviously for decades after 1945, the bomb was the sum of all fears. That was the apocalyptic scenario, and it was hard for anything else to get a look in. And the ones that seem to kind of keep pressing on people right now, obviously climate crisis and AI, which has just in the last decade sort of become the thing that people most want to worry about, although the reality of actually what's going on and what you should be worrying about is perhaps less clear.
And Chris, what's your take? I mean, what's your position, for instance, on AI? I mean, presumably there aren't many archaeological references for that sort of thing, but what would be your approach to looking at the subject of AI in an apocalyptic scenario?
I guess a basic way to look at it would be, what sort of infrastructure does it depend on? And are you talking about a situation where that infrastructure is not going to be viable? You know, I think that when you think about AI, for me, it seems the danger seems to be in the path it might lead you down. And the, you know, the results will be something else. I guess I'm not expecting, you know, a Terminator type situation, but rather it exacerbates bad decision making, or it allows sort of, you know, people to be convincing in ways that's not beneficial for the group as a whole.
Dorian, I would assume that the apocalypse is always, well, at least until recently, has been a kind of religious concept. Do you think that there's something innate within human beings that kind of focuses on the end times, on the end of the world?
Well, you get the sort of birth of the secular end of the world about 200 years ago with the Romantics. You know, it's a certain point in the Enlightenment. But the patterns, the thought patterns of the religious apocalypse recur over and over again. And one of the almost most sort of vicious criticisms you can make of people warning about real world existential threats is that they sound like Renaissance or medieval apocalypticists. So one political scientist, Rob Reich, called the long-termists, who worry a lot about AI, that includes people like Nick Bostrom and Elon Musk, they compare him to Savonarola, who was responsible for the Bonfire of the Vanities in Florence, and is this sort of famous millenarian preacher. So we're still sort of stuck even as a complete non-believer like myself, I'm aware of these thought patterns of apocalyptic transformation, of prophecy, of dread of the end times. And that language infiltrates discussions of nuclear weapons, of AI, of the climate crisis. They're sort of deeply embedded in our brains.
And Chris, is it fair to sort of summarise your own position as being slightly more optimistic in a way of looking at the apocalypse, in that you think that humans can prepare themselves for the future by looking back at past disasters? Is that fair?
Well, perhaps. I would say it's sort of relatively optimistic, perhaps, compared to some real pessimists. But yeah, certainly we can prepare, and certainly we can change the course of things to some degree. Paralysis or hopelessness isn't the way to go. And that, I think, could be seen as sort of optimistic. Often sort of my focus on community rather than individual is seen as optimistic, which I suppose it is, although to me it just sounds much more difficult, to tell you the truth. You know, these apocalyptic narratives where it's just you and your little group and you're up in the hills surviving, that sounds relatively doable. What seems much harder is how do you reproduce, you know, an agricultural system, a water system, an educational system for the millions and billions of people that could potentially need them after some sort of catastrophe.
And finally, Chris and Dorian, just to wrap up, could you say in a few words, do you think humanity does face in its future at some point an immediate kind of cessation of existence? And if so, what do you think will cause it?
I mean, I'm inclined more towards that there are lots of things to worry about which would be incredibly bad and would cause a massive deterioration in our quality of life and damage to civilization without being the end of the world. And even the most pessimistic people, you know, about, for example, the climate crisis will say, well, it wouldn't mean human extinction. And most of these things, even like a large-scale nuclear war during the Cold War, would probably not have meant the end of the world. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't be worried. And I do think that the reason why people are so animated about AI now, that is in the most kind of far-out scenarios, that is something that long-term is like Toby Ord suggest could lead to literally the extinction of humanity, which is a far more terminal scenario from which you cannot rebuild. And what Chris is talking about is the ability of communities to rebuild after pretty horrific catastrophes throughout history. And I think that's the sort of thing that has happened and the thing that could happen again. What is much less likely, without a kind of equivalent of the asteroid that, you know, destroyed the dinosaurs, is just the complete cessation of life on Earth. So I don't know whether that counts as optimistic.
Yeah, I think I have some very similar thoughts. There's, you know, the extinction of humankind seems, that's not a compelling scenario. What I think is much more likely to be the worrisome part of this is that as things get worse, whatever is causing it, then other sorts of systems break down and you have changes in ways people make decisions. Look what happened during, you know, the Great Depression with the rise of fascism or any other thing where you have a sort of a proximal cause that starts this chain of events that results in something much worse. So I think what you would face in a scenario where you had really bad results from climate change would be some really ugly political changes first.
I would just add that I found while researching the book, the one really comforting thing was the number of times people had predicted catastrophes that hadn't happened. And that sometimes these things have happened, but more often than not, and our fears tend to be greater than the reality. And arguably, sometimes our fears help us avoid the catastrophe.
Brilliant. What an uplifting note. Dorian and Chris, thank you very much. And that's it for this week. If you enjoyed the podcast, why not pick up the latest edition of the magazine to read the articles we've discussed and more. I'm Gus Carter.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, and we hope you'll join us again next week.